Thank you very much. Again, let me thank the organizers for organizing this wonderful meeting here. And I take the liberty to not to talk about any kind of wave equations or anything of that sort, but instead I will center the thoughts around a topic which is roughly related to the Boltzmann equation. And I will show you a few of these motivations sprinkled throughout the talk. So the first thing goes to the ancients. I think it's something which Maxwell, so I would like to talk about, of course, work which is joint with Eric Carlin and Elliot Leeb. And I want to motivate my talk first by talking about the equivalence of ensembles. And this is a calculation which goes back to the ancients. I think Maxwell already knew it. Namely, imagine you take the sphere in n minus 1 dimensions, in n dimensional. So the sphere itself is n minus 1 dimensional. You take it of radius squared of n, and you calculate marginals. In other words, you integrate over all variables. So V1 up to Vn are the variables, the square sum up to n, and then you integrate over all the ones from k plus 1 up to n, and you ask yourself, what do you get when you calculate this integral? Here, this is the normalized surface measure of the sphere, okay? And it's a simple calculation. What you get, of course, is, I just wrote down a few formulas here, you get a Gaussian. Big surprise, right? So, in a certain sense, Gaussian measure is related to marginals of a sphere of very, very large radius in very, very high dimensions. That's what the ancients realized. So in particular, for example, when you, by the way, this mu n always denotes unit, the normalized surface measure on the sphere. So if you, for example, would like to calculate such kind of quantities, expectation values, what can you do? In the limit, this just deteriorate to integrals over Gaussian measures, okay? So this is the starting point of a whole theory which is called Wiener space. So in particular, for example, this is all well known. If you take two functions f depends on V1, g depends on V2, you integrate this product. In other words, you calculate the correlation, and you see that when n tends to infinity, these things become independent. Okay? So my next question I ask is, well, how does this carry over to the notion of entropy? So what do I mean by that? Okay? So let me start with a function now on Gauss space. Capital F is a function on Gauss space. I look at its marginal, just a function of one variable. And now I define two kinds of entropies. The one is the entropy of the big function f, and the other ones are the entropies of the marginals. And it's a very simple theorem, namely that the entropy is subadditive. In other words, the sum of the entropies of the marginals always dominates the entropy of the full function. Okay? This is very easy to prove. No, it doesn't have to be. No, that's right. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to. It has nothing to do with symmetry. That's right. So, next, just for the sake of simplicity, let me show you how to do that. It's very simple. It's just a judicious application of Jensen's inequality. You take the function x log x, which all of you know is convex. You write out this ratio. Right, which you see that this right-hand side, because I normalize my f, right? F has to be a probability function. I know also that the marginals are normalized, so this is, again, a probability measure. And then I apply Jensen, and what you see when you work it out, you just get zero as a lower bound. In other words, what is at work here is the independence, right? The variables V1 to Vn with Gauss measures are independent variables, okay? So this is so good, so trivial in a certain sense. Now, what I'm asking next is, what happens on Sn minus 1? You see, on Sn minus 1, you have the different coordinate functions, but these coordinate functions, the squares have to add up to n, so they're not independent anymore. Okay? What can you say? So again, I define a marginal. Now, what is the marginal this time? Well, I just integrate all the variables v2 up to n over the sphere and keep the variable v1 fixed. Now, the way you should think about this is simply this. You fix your one variable, you average over all rotations, which keep that direction fixed. Okay? That's the way one should think about it. And now I ask the same question again. Well, is there any kind of subadditivity of the entropy? Would be nice if this is 1. Well, I'm sure it's not going to be, because these variables are not independent. So what is it? So let me just make a little excursion into the question, what would be a good guess for this constant? You would certainly expect it should depend on n, and what you also expect is n goes to infinity, this should tend to 1, right? After all, when n goes to infinity, these variables become more and more independent. So let's see. So let me start with the usual story. I mean, what do you try? I mean, you say right away, aha, there's of course a function which I can plug in and immediately figure out what the values are. Namely, I plug in the constant function, the function 1. I get here 0, have equality, so this better be, I mean, this can be any constant. It doesn't tell anything about the constant, right? But I can now expand around the constant function. That's what one usually does. So here's what I do. So you write your f as 1 plus epsilon capital H, and of course you assume that the H is perpendicular to 1. What do I mean by perpendicular? The think of it as a Hilbert space over the sphere, right? Then H is in the usual L2 in the product perpendicular to the function 1. Now you do the averaging, right? PIF is of course just 1 plus epsilon PIH. PIH, of course, is still perpendicular to 1, and now you happily expand, right, in epsilon. So what you always notice in this business is that the epsilon term cancels out, and you have to compare the epsilon squared terms, and you lead to such an inequality. By the way, the PIs, I forgot to say, are projections in L2. Yeah, this is very simple. It's just this averaging. Okay, so question, can you find a decent estimate on this quadratic form? And of course, you know how to do that. You just work out the Euler-Lagrange equation, which is an eigenvalue equation. It leads to such an equation as I've written down here. And the nice thing about this is disgustingly simple to work out, right? Because let's take the H symmetric. I can do this also in the unsymmetric case, but for simplicity. Then what you notice here, this is always a function, the same function, just of a different variable, right? So in other words, the left-hand side, despite the fact it's a function in this huge space, it's just a sum of functions of one variable, which of course immediately leads to a simple eigenvalue equation for this function little h, which you can work out. And it turns out that, let me show you the next slide, that this eigenvalue lambda, which is also the largest constant, is this number up here. That's what this number is. Okay? And by the way, this number has sort of an interesting interpretation, namely this alpha n. What this alpha n really measures is the next order in the decorrelation on the sphere. In other words, when you take the limit as n goes to infinity, functions of a single particle marginal become uncorrelated. Well, how fast do they become uncorrelated? Well, in the worst case, in the best case, they go like 3 over n squared minus 1. Okay? This is an estimate, right? So this is, if you like, a correction term to the equivalence of ensembles. And what you see here nicely, you get 1 plus 3 over n plus 1. When n tends to infinity, this goes towards 1. That's precisely what we want. Okay? So this is all good. Now let me just sort of as a sprinkle in between tell you why I'm interested in such kind of questions. And this has to do with kinetic theory. Maybe I've heard of the master equation of Mark Katz, which describes random collisions of n particles. And this is in the spatially homogeneous case, and what you can write down, or what he did, was a master equation of the following type. You think of capital F as a function of the velocities, v1 up to vn. You also know that decent collisions should preserve energy. So you know that the sphere as n minus 1 is preserved under these collisions, right? When, this, when the particles sum up, the vi squared sum up to number n, after the collision, the square still should sum up to number n. So what then Katz wrote down is the following answers for Q. Now, what is it? Well, you think it in the following fashion. You pick randomly a pair of particles. You pick a random collision angle. This is the collision law in one dimension. Yeah? As you note, of course, this doesn't satisfy conservation of momentum. But, of course, you can't in one dimension really unless the particles go through each other or exchange velocities. And this is terribly uninteresting. Right? After all, we would like to understand something about how systems evolve, how they approach equilibrium, and these sorts of questions. Okay, so here is this randomization. You pick your probability distribution. You pick arbitrary pair of particles, I and j. You average over the collision angle. This gives an operator rij. You look at the q, which is just the average over the pairs. You plug it in here, and you get a semigroup. Okay? And now what is the question? Well, it's very easy to see, by the way, that this semigroup is ergodic. So in other words, when you start with NEF, probability measure, you will converge to the function 1. The interesting question, which actually was open for about 40 years, was, well, how fast is it doing it? So here is the answer, which has been worked out not long ago by various by a joint paper with Eric Collin and Maria Carvalho. Namely, you start with your so this is your initial condition. This is the evolved function. You subtract 1 on both sides. This is how it decays. And delta n is not just an estimate. You can compute it exactly. It's 1/2 n plus 1, n plus 2 over n minus 1. Now, the way it comes out is this, that you find an estimate on the gap in terms of recursion in this form, and you see this number alpha n, which you had before on the transparency, shows up in a prominent fashion. Okay. Now, as you all know, the gap is nice, except it's actually not a very good measure for approach to equilibrium. What one really should do is look at the approach to equilibrium in terms of the entropy. Since Boltzmann, we know that. That's the right thing to do. So, therefore, now you can imagine what would be very nice to put entropies on both sides. And the next slide tells you that all the intuition which I tried to push upon you is wrong. And that's the bad news. So let me write down, actually, let me start first with the corollary. The corollary says that you don't have subadditivity of the entropy. It says that the sum of the entropies of the marginals is bounded below by twice the entropy of the full function. And this number 2 is sharp. You can find actually a trial function which gets as close as you like to this case. Right? This function is a corollary of a following Young-type inequality. You take your functions fi of a single variable. You take the product, you integrate this over the sphere, and you ask yourself, well, how big can it get when I measure the size of this function in terms of LP norms? As it turns out, you have such an inequality as long as p is greater or equals 2. The constant in front is 1. This is sharp. And whenever you try to push upon this inequality of p, which is less than 2, you can always find functions where this number here is infinity and this one is finite. So in a certain sense, this idea, which we all have about equivalence of ensembles, namely that when you just take the n large enough, somehow things will sort of resemble Gauss measure, will be represented by Gauss measure, is on the level of entropy at least, that the level of subadditive entropy is wrong. It's completely wrong. And in my view, we haven't really understood this limit so far. So now what I want to spend, so this is what's motivation. I would like to spend now some time to show you a kind of a new idea how you can get your hands on such kind of inequalities. You see, the problem in this inequality is that you have no way of guessing what the indices are, right? Because you have no scaling. There's no dimensional analysis which helps you. The dimensions are fixed. I mean, of course, it has to be homogeneous. That's trivial. But there's no scaling which allows you to tell you what kind of P should be there. So let me show you a proof. And I want to show you a proof of this inequality up here. And what you do is you construct a semigroup which preserves the right-hand side but increases the left-hand side to a limit which you can calculate. And then you have the inequality. And how do we do this? Use angular momentum, or rather Laplace-Beltrami. So, I don't know, I think all of you know this formula, right? Lij, that's the angular momentum in the ij plane. Physicists know that usually, so I assume it's still okay. So, the Lij, right? I've written down Vi dvdj, dvj minus vj d dvi, and then you write down the Laplace-Beltrami, which is just sum of the angular momentum squared. So what is the idea? You take the following kind of semigroup. You take g to the p. You apply the heat kernel, and then you take the pth root. Obviously, this prescription has the property that it fixes the LP norm. It's obvious, right? By construction. And of course, it will always assume that the function is greater or equal to zero, right? Because it's clear that the left-hand side is biggest when all the functions are positive. Now, it's essentially obvious, namely from the spectral representation of the heat kernel, that when you let time go to infinity, that this function gvt converges just to a constant, which is the LP norm of the function. Next. What is the derivative? Well, this just to work it out. You get a little bit of a complicated mess here, but this is not further a big deal. Also note, by the way, that I should also say this, because when you start with a function of one single variable and you apply the heat kernel of this type to it, you have to make sure that you still get a function of a single variable. And that, of course, you do because of the symmetry. All right? So, now, let me look at the function phi of t, which is just Sn minus 1, the integral of this product over Sn minus 1 with respect to the normalized measure. And then, as everybody does, we differentiate. So when you differentiate this mass, remember, the right-hand side stays fixed. Nothing changes there. It's only the left-hand side which is interesting. So that's what you get. And the great miracle is that you get a full square. Right? Let me not go to the calculation. I think you all know how to complete squares. Right? It's just the miracle is that this works out very nicely. And everything works out in terms of this logarithm of gk. Now, you might complain that this gk might be zero, but you know it's not, because when you let the flow go a little bit, it's immediately strictly positive, and you don't have any problems working this out. Okay? So, and now the story is very simple. Phi of 0, which you start, is certainly phi less than or equals phi infinity. After all, phi of t increases. Phi infinity is just the product. I choose p equals 2, the product of the two norms. And phi of 0 itself, it's just what we started out with, the initial condition, and there is your inequality. So good, so trivial, right? But of course, you need to have this idea to put the Laplacian in it, right? And then, of course, the corollary is very easy. It's again the same argument, except remember what you have to do. The integral f is 1, so the marginals are also probability measures. But you cannot stick in the product of the FIs as we did before, because you have no estimate of the integral of the product in terms of the L1 norms. There isn't such a thing. So what you do is you take the roots. And when you work this all out, you get precisely the subadditivity, quote unquote, with a factor of 2. Now, that these things are sharp is just a matter of plugging in some trial functions, which I spare you the details. That's a long calculation. Yes? I didn't. Except that it's wrong. You see? Where is it? This ventilator here, right? You see, this would, what shall I say? How shall I say this? Let me think about this. Huh? I mean, there's a twist to this story which I don't recall at the moment. So, okay. Now, the next question which you would like to address is, so this is kind of a sort of a nice little method to do all of this. I know now where I used the p bigger than 2. Yeah, that's right. When you work out the derivatives, you see here, that's the reason why I wrote this down, I remember now. You see this p minus 1. Eventually, you have to make an integration by parts, getting this gradient over to match it up with the Laplacian when you have differentiated the phi out, okay? And what will happen there is you will get a factor of p minus 2, which you have to have positive. Otherwise, it's not going to work, okay? That's what it is. Thanks. But this is sort of hidden in the details of the calculation. So, next. Now, this is now a simple method, and one might ask oneself, can we use this method for other purposes too? So this is, let's do it this way. Okay, so let me talk about Young's inequality. And so what is it? I use it in a fairly general form. You have to imagine now that you give yourself n vectors in Rm. Okay, and n is usually greater or equals m. Okay, so this is going to be hard for the pronunciation, right? Because n and m sounds almost the same. So n is usually larger or equals than m. You give yourself n functions on R. You calculate the integral of this product. And this is a famous result. Namely, there exists a constant such that this is less than the product of the p norms, except now the sum of the 1 over pi's have to add up to m. All right? Now, this inequality, you see, here you have a scaling, since you are on Rn, or Rm. And therefore, this determines what the relation are between these exponents. Now, a special case, for example, is the Young inequality, which surely all of you know, namely this one here, where 1 over p plus 1 over q plus 1 over r is equals 2. It's just a two-dimensional integral. And you choose the a1s, the a2s, and the a3s in this fashion. Then you match it up with this form up here. By the way, notice this, of course, is quite analogous to the problem which you had looked at before on the sphere, right? Where the EIs, however, are just perpendicular vectors. Let me drive the analogy a little bit further. Suppose I look at a constraint problem. Before, what were the constraints? The constraints were that the sum of the vi squared was equals n. So you had to stay on the sphere. Now suppose I do a different problem. I would like to look at the planar constraint problem, namely the coordinate functions should be on a plane. Okay? You see, this would be another intuition. You could say, isn't it true that the worst case in this Young inequality on the sphere should sort of show up when you scale things up around some point, and you basically see that this whole thing pans out to be flat, and essentially a result of Rn. Well, this is quite a reasonable attitude, but it's the wrong one. Namely, what you easily can prove, I mean, from a theorem which I'm going to show how to prove, that this product over the space integrated against this Gauss measure is less than the product, and here you have n over n minus 1. Okay? Which gives you, by the way, a superadditivity result for the entropy, which has now nicely factor n over n minus 1, which indeed goes towards 1 as n goes to infinity. Okay? So you see, this constraint is extremely different from the constraint on the sphere, despite the fact that these variables are dependent. It's a much, much weaker dependence. And let me just ignore this for the moment here. So now, what are the results about Young's inequality in generality? Here is, it's actually, what we're doing is reproving an old result of Brascombe and Leib, which is the following. So what do? You go and stick in your Young inequality Gaussians. Gaussians of the form, so they are centered Gaussians, they're real Gaussians, with the variance given by these numbers Sj, you plug them in, you work out what this integral is, it's usually a mess, and then you take the supremum over all these numbers Sj, and that gives you a number d-twiddle. And the claim is that this d-twiddle is indeed the sharp constant in the full Young inequality. In other words, if you look for the optimizers in Young's inequality, all you have to do, you have to look at them among Gaussian functions. Now, mind you, this doesn't really tell you how you calculate the actual constant. That's still a hard problem. But you all agree with me that you really have to reduce the problem to something much, much simpler now. Okay. So, now, what should the proof be of such a thing? Well, we do the same as before. Here's what we do. We pick an m by m invertible matrix. We calculate a heat kernel. And then we proceed in the same fashion as before. So here is your heat, the generator. And now you calculate e to the tl applied to this function, right? And what you notice is, that's very easy to see, that if the initial function was of this form, namely a function of a single variable, just a dot x, then when you apply this L, it doesn't really matter what the R is, it always stays as a function of this form. And this follows from the simple fact that all directions perpendicular, the function is constant, and heat kernels preserve this constancy, right? So this is important to note. And now you stick in again a nonlinear heat semigroup. What do? You take Fj to the Pj, you apply the heat semigroup to it and take the Pj's root. Again, this preserves the right side, and the left side is going to be an integral over function of the, over this function. Let me call this a of t. Good, and then you differentiate. And this is a long calculation. Well, it's straightforward, right? I mean, you can give it to any undergraduate, and that's what you get. Okay? So you get, again, a quadratic form matched with the hi prime, hj prime, and what are those? These are just the logarithm of these fj's, right? And the matrix you can work out, this is just given in terms of the aj's of the p's and the r, of course, which I've chosen at the beginning. And now what is the goal? The goal is very simple. You say, well, let's find the r so that this q is positive. Yeah? You know what the asymptotes are of heat kernels, namely they are Gaussians. Even this, in this nonlinear thing, it's very easy to see, must be Gaussians, and that will prove the theorem, right? Except it's not so simple. Because this q has some information encoded which is non-trivial. Let me just try to sort of highlight this a little bit. Remember, there's this condition that the sum of the 1 over pi's has to add up to m. Well, does it do that? I mean, how is this encoded in this qij? Well, you can write this equation in this fashion here, right? Just pulling out the square root of pi's and the magnitude of the Rij out. And what you see is you get this matrix here, which is delta ij minus an inner product matrix, a Gram matrix. This must be positive. Let's call this vector ci, and what it says is that this identity minus this sum must be positive. And when you take traces, you learn, because of this condition here, that the 1 over pi's add up to m, that the trace is 0. So in other words, you have to find the r in such a way that these vectors ei, when you take the projections, multiply them by 1 over pi, that they add up to the identity. Right? This is a nonlinear problem, which is somewhat tricky to work out. Okay. So this Q, we have to find this Q. Story, nevertheless, is fairly easy. What do you do? You say, well, after all, I have a variational problem for this D twiddle. Remember, I stick in the Gaussians, I optimize over Gaussians, I get my constant. Now, what is this optimization problem? It's very simple. Here, I have worked out what the integral over Gaussians is. I just take the logarithm. So all you have to do is you have to optimize over the variables S. And when you do this, you get the following variational equation. I've written it here. So here's the variational equation, which you can also write in this fashion here. Now what you see, here's the matrix S, right, which contains all these unknown exponents, which I have to calculate. The matrix A is just the matrix of these column vectors A1 to AN. And what you notice is, this is a simple fact from linear algebra, is that this here is a projection. And now you simply go, you choose your R in this way, you calculate what the Q is. Q is 1 minus P, this orthogonal projection, and you see this is clearly positive. Right? So what is the story? The story is that if I have an optimizer for the variational problem for the Gaussians, I know that in this case, D twiddle is equal to D. And I'm done. Okay? And then, of course, comes the next question. Well, what happens when you don't have optimizers? Right? Or do you always have optimizers? Well, this is, again, dealt with. Well, let me just summarize this here, what I've said so far. If sup over Gaussians is a max, then D is equals D twiddle. Okay? That's the question. So now you can explore this further. Let me go now and try to explain what happens if there aren't any optimizers. Okay? So now look, the variables Z, which I've introduced here, I've just introduced because I don't want to write constantly 1 over pi. Okay? So Zi is 1 over pi. That's the way you should think about it. Okay? So, now what does it mean to calculate the supremum over Gaussians? It really means to calculate the Legendre transform, if you like, of this function here, right? Which comes, and this function, I just use these coordinates, log Sj equals Tj. Then I can write this function this fashion. And this is the function which comes out when you integrate these Gaussians, right, as we all know. So you have to calculate the sup. Now, the next definition is kind of interesting. Namely, let's look at the collection of vectors z. Again, remember, the z's are the 1 over pj's. Huh? So the sum of the components should be m. The cj should be between 0 and 1. And there should be an additional condition. Namely, take any subset s of the elements 1 to n. Look at the vectors which have the index set, the indices in this set S. Well, this is a bunch of vectors. Now, what you do with these vectors? Well, you look at the dimension of the space which these vectors span. Now you require that these ZJs, when you sum J in S, add up to a number which is not bigger than this rank. Okay? Okay, so this is a convex set, obviously. It's less obvious to see that this is actually a simplex, but that's not important for the moment. Now, what's the point about this set? Well, I admit this function is a little bit, this condition is a little bit outlandish. What does it mean? It means the following. Let me explain this. This is in fact a sort of something which has escaped all the previous works. It's the following story. Look, write the big integral here as an integral where you just first take the product of the function of the indices in S, and then afterwards the indices in SC in the complement. Okay. Now you know you can easily see that you can choose coordinates in such a way that the integral looks this way, bj dot y, and here could bj dot y plus cj dot z prime. Okay? I just use c prime because I don't want to mix it up with the z's. All right? So that's what you see. Now what you do is you do a partial scaling. And by the way, remember the dimension of these vectors a, and therefore also the bj's, which are in the range of these a's, is just r. Okay? That's what it is. That's the rank. So now you do a partial scaling. In other words, you go and you scale only the functions whose index is in S. Okay? So then this whole integral turns out to be an integral of this form. Namely, you have scaled the fj's in here, and those you leave untouched. And when you work out the scaling, what you get the following relation, namely, this comes out. Right? You get the lambda minus r out from the integration, and then the product j and s lambda to the 1 over pj. And now you agree with me, if this sum is bigger than r, the integral diverges, and the inequality is not satisfied, obviously. Right? So this explains why you need this strange-looking condition. The sum of the CJs must be less or equal to the rank of the space spanned by these vectors whose index is in J. Okay. So good. By the way, notice this partial scaling, of course, I've chosen in such a way that the PJ norms are unchanged, right? So, and now it's very simple to finish the rest. Namely, here are a bunch of observations. Remember, what is this phi a star? That's the constant, when you exponentiate it, that's the constant which you get when optimizing over Gaussians. All right? That's what this number is. All right? I've written it down once more here. Now, it turns out that when the z is in the interior of this convex set, in the interior, you have a max. It's not hard to see. It takes me, however, a couple of pages to show that. Let me not do it here. So you have a maximum. Now, so therefore, where is the problem now? The problem resides on the boundary. What happens on the boundary? So let me therefore take a z which sits on the boundary. And again, remember, the zi of these indices is 1 over pi. Well, since it sits on the boundary, I must certainly find a set S so that the sum of the cj's add up to r, the rank of these vectors aj with index in S. Okay. Now, remember this formula here. Look at this formula here. What can I do? I can just brutally go and simply say, let me estimate this integral here by the product of the LP numbers of Fj and S with J and S complement, and this product here by the LP product of the LP norms, with, of course, the correct constant. So in other words, what do I realize? I realize that if I define these two numbers here, that the constant D must be less than the product of the constant DS and DSC. So, and now you are in an induction situation, right? Because what you do is, suppose this DS, the Gaussian, when you optimize over Gaussians in this problem, suppose this is not attained. What do you do? Well, you start splitting up, right? Because if you're inside, it's attained. You have another set KA, which belongs to this set of indices. If you're inside, the maximum is attained. You know how to optimize it. You get Gaussians. And we are not inside, well, you can break it up into pieces. Right? It's a peeling off argument. So therefore, you always realize that the D is less or equals the product of these where the maximum is attained. So you might say, well, but maybe you have a strict inequality between the two. But you don't. And the reason is very simple. When you go back to this formula and you plunk in Gaussians for this one, you can easily work out, where did I put this? Here. What this product is, it turns out to be itself a Gaussian. And since you can scale that stuff into delta function, you can come in this integral here as close to a delta function around zero as you like. In other words, these variables here become irrelevant, and you see that you can approach this product of these constants here as closely as you like. Okay? Now, I understand this is somewhat tricky because the high dimensionality gets a little bit sort of out of bound here. But this method really works like a charm. It gives many, many more results. As I said before, you get the convexity of the set Ka. You get that this is a simplex. You also get all the optimizers. You see, usually this is a hard problem. I mean, to prove an inequality is often fine. This is one thing. But do you know? Can you establish all the cases of equality? You can do this with this method. You get all of them, and I would say this kills about this problem as much as one can kill it. I mean, we're stopping short, essentially, of actually calculating the constant. Okay? So this is a little glimpse of a method to calculate sharp constants in inequalities using essentially a PDE method. Thanks.